it's all about us, and it's time to bow down. Hello, everybody. Welcome to, I believe this is our fourth episode of Bow Down. Dennis and I, as always, are so excited to be here with all of you. But also, Dennis, I'm so excited to be here with you today and just continue this ongoing conversation that we're having.
Reese, as always, it's such a pleasure. And once again, I just have to say you look so lovely. And for folks who are just listening, you know, you should get the video version because you get the full... Get the full picture here, but I'm honored to be here as always. Can't wait to see where we go, and I can't believe it's been four episodes already.
Isn't that wild?
It feels like it hasn't been, but yet at the same time, it feels like we've been doing this for like 4 years. So it's amazing how time is a little bit plastic there, isn't it?
Yeah, and I do think when you catch yourself in the midst of that feeling, right, of the, oh, this is something, it kind of has that weird feeling. It's like, follow that, right? That it's when you're in flow, when time kind of fades away, that it's like, okay, if I'm in flow doing this, you should probably keep paying attention to it. So I think that's a good sign.
Record it because good things happen, right?
Right. And record it. Well, to kickstart us today, one thing that both of us from a few episodes ago have been thinking about and really felt called to discuss was this idea of the sublime and how that relates to the womanly and feminine experience. And for me, sublimity in the romantic experience, and romantic in the sense of the like aesthetic quality and literary period, not how we colloquially use the word romance today, has always been something that really, really resonated with me in my experience of life, in that these things that tend to be scary are also the things that tend to captivate my interest and my attention. And I think that that is something that's pretty unique, to the human experience, right? That all humans share. But I think there's something that other animals probably don't have that calling to investigate what lies beneath the dark well or around the corner, right? There is something really interesting in that to me. And I just want to start with a snippet from a poem from Percy Blythe Shelley, who, of course, everyone will be familiar with Mary Wollstonecraft Shelley, who is the author of Frankenstein, and Percy Blythe Shelley is her father, I believe, unless I'm getting my history wrong. I will definitely correct myself in the description if I am, but it's been a hot second since I've been really entrenched in the literature, but this poem has always been really powerful for me, and it's a long poem. And so I just want to read a snippet, and it is from Alistair or The Spirit of Solitude by Percy Blythe Shelley. And at the very beginning, there is a epigraph from the Confessions of St. Augustine, and it is in Latin, so I will be reading the English translation. I was not yet in love, and I loved to be in love. I sought what I might love, in love with loving. And then Percy goes on in his beautiful poetic language to tell us, weave this story. And the second stanza begins, Mother of this unfathomable world, favor my solemn song, for I have loved thee ever and thee only. I have watched thy shadow and the darkness of thy steps, and my heart ever gazes on the depth of thy deep mysteries. I have made my bed in charnels and on coffins, where black death keeps record of the trophies won from thee, hoping to still these obstinate questionings of thee and thine by forcing some lone ghost, thy messenger, to render up the tale of what we are. And of course, this is just a little bit at the beginning, but I mean, mother of this unfathomable world, how does that not just grab you? And so immediately calls into mind this idea of the feminine, But of course, this is a poem written by a man, which I think is interesting too for the work that we're doing here. So yeah, I'll toss it back to you, Dennis. Any immediate thoughts or things that are coming up for you with this epigraph and the little snippet from this poem?
You know, what really struck me is absolutely the beauty of everything. I mean, just the pure poetic beauty of love, but this idea of I love to love. And that's something that really resonates with me, because I think some of us love easily, but some of us don't love so easily. Mm. But I think it's universal that as humans we want to give our love to another, and I think oftentimes we're scared to do so. And as I reflect on that, this softness kind of overwhelms me when I listen to that, this idea of the human experience is this search to not to be loved, which is where I think a lot of us, in order to be loved, you have to love. It's the only way I think you can receive that love. And I do wonder, I wonder how many of our listeners struggle, with it being able to be loved. Like, do they do? And I wonder if, I'm curious from your perspective as a woman, is it hard to be loved? Do you find it challenging when somebody does show you love? What comes up for you, or does it feel genuine, or does it feel, particularly that there's an ulterior motive, that this isn't they're trying to seduce me, or they're looking for something from me, or what comes up for you? I'm curious when somebody does express in, whether it's words or actions, love, how do you feel about it as a woman?
Yeah. Real quickly, before I dive into my experience, I want to go back to something you said at the beginning, this idea of we must be loving to be loved, right? And I think this idea of being in love, whether it is with one other person or with ourselves or experience or a broader community, it does feel like love is this kind of pocket that can encapsulate all of that. And I think to kind of be initiated into this like sacred space of love takes that vulnerability from everybody. And so even in this little epigraph saying, I was not yet in love, I loved to be in love, there is this already sublime feeling that is invoked in this. Love is also deeply terrifying, and also deeply beautiful. And to let that lead into kind of more of my experience around love, I think that, of course, my first thoughts go to romantic love, and I think we could probably explore a little bit more what we mean when we say love and maybe how we would each define that. I'd be curious to know how you define the word. But any time that I find myself in the receiving position of love, I don't know if it doesn't feel manipulative to me. It doesn't feel like the rug is going to be pulled out from under me. It doesn't feel as though like I'm just trying to be seduced or whatever. I think that I tend to discard that kind of feeling pretty quickly as like, oh, this is not love. But I think something that I really struggle with is, particularly in romantic relationships, is when I am told that I am loved, I immediately reject it, because there is this feeling of, there is no way you could love me, because how could you ever know me? You actually don't know me. Therefore, the thing that you're saying cannot be true. And it is not in a, like, I'm trying to discount this emotion that this other person holds towards me. I still believe that that is a beautiful thing, and I feel grateful to be the recipient of it. But it also feels almost like a lie that someone doesn't know that they're telling. And I think that that is both indicative of my own inability to receive, right? Of there is this like trust that love calls for in, I'm not in that other person's shoes. I don't know what it feels like to be in love with me. I don't know how they experience me. I never could, because I will always only be experiencing through the lens of, quote, Reese. So I do think there's a bit of arrogance in that reaction, but I think that that is the ego trying to protect myself in some ways. But in other ways that maybe aren't as self-critical, I do think that there is some truth in this. No one will ever know me in the way that I know myself. And any love that someone else could truly hold for me will never be as comprehensive as a love I can hold for myself because of that truth. And so I think it's not a thing that's easy for me to throw away. I think I still very much kind of scramble for it and want to grab onto it and hold it near and dear, because who doesn't want to feel so precious to another human being, right? But like in the darkest of darks at night, when I've been in relationships, that is the thing that kind of creeps out, is it's not true. And not because they have some ulterior motive, not because they want something deeper from you or anything, but because they don't know you. So what is it to love you? Not just to love, but to love you. Yeah, I don't know. I guess I'll leave it there, since I've kind of been going on for a little bit.
No, and that's just beautiful and honest and sincere, and it resonates so strongly in this. You know, if they only knew me, like that, you know, if he only knew who I was, or if she knew what I was really thinking, then, you know, you can say you love me, but you don't really know me, right? And that's, you know, why do we put up obstacles for ourselves, you know, essentially? That's really just what we're doing. What would it be like to live life and just, you know, take that at face value?
Yeah.
And receive it. But ultimately you're right. It is self-love, right? If there's parts of us that feel we're not lovable. And so I wonder what it would be like to be with someone where you could put all of those parts out there, all of the ugly parts, all of which there are none, by the way. I have to say that there are no ugly parts. To everyone listening, I don't care how dark you think your part is. I don't think how terrible you think what you want is, or your desires are. They're not. And it's a lie you've been told, because you wouldn't have these desires if they weren't good in some senses. And so, yeah, I mean, to me, to find, to love yourself enough to allow somebody else to love you is a special thing. And
yeah.
And because ultimately, nobody else can fill that hole you're feeling.
Yeah.
And that's what leads to a lot of dysfunction in relationships. It's what leads to a lot of struggles. But I, you know, that resonates so strongly, because I think we've all said that, you know, I'm not good enough. Like, you know, and it comes down to these beliefs. It's a fundamental belief of I'm not really lovable. Somewhere in there.
Yeah. Yeah. Hey y'all, Reese hopping in for a quick note about the next portion of the conversation. I'm about to get into my experience with a personal relationship that I had in high school. And firstly, you'll notice there are a few cuts. This is just to protect the identity and privacy of the other person involved. And secondly, I want to be super clear that anything I talk about with my experience is purely an indictment on me and my lack of healing and the flaws that I had within this relationship and no one else. It is more from a place of personal reflection and the things that I did wrong, the things that I messed up in that relationship and not anyone else. And I hold nothing but gratitude for these memories and for this person that really taught me a lot, clearly, by this conversation. So just wanted to make that super clear before telling this personal story, and I hope that you enjoy it. I do want to talk about my personal experiences and the ways that I can learn and grow and hopefully help others learn and grow through my personal stories, but I always want to do so in a kind, loving, and ethical way. Also, a little bit later on in the conversation, I touch briefly on the definition of woman and womanhood, and I want to be extremely, extremely clear when I say this. Fuck TERFs. Feminism always has, always will, and always should include trans women. Trans women are women, and as feminists, that has to be at the forefront of the work we are doing as well. I also want to own that my privilege is on full display in this conversation. I say the phrase, I don't really care what society says a woman is, and I think that that is just the perfect example of my privilege as a straight, white, cis woman, that I don't need to worry about society viewing me as a woman or not, and I have the freedom to define what womanhood means to me because it is not questioned. It should not matter how anyone else defines womanhood. It should only matter the way we define that for ourselves as women. But it does matter so that all women are protected in the freedom of being who they fully are. Everyone deserves the full freedom to be who they are. And that is why the definition is important and why we need to keep fighting as feminists for an expansive and inclusive definition of womanhood on the public stage. Okay. Thank you for tuning in to this little note and to the podcast in general. And now back to the main conversation. Totally. I think, too, there is something in this. We've talked a lot on the podcast about masking and this idea of the mask and what that means. And I think one thing that's really coming up for me right now, too, is I believe so strongly in my mask being deeply lovable. The Reese that has been curated for public consumption is wonderful, great, fabulous. And I'll even, and so there is this like side kind of underneath of like, well, just don't. You don't gotta take off the mask. And any time in any relationship that I kind of began to, or the mask slipped a little bit on accident or whatever, or there's a moment of vulnerability, that was always the kind of root of the biggest like discord. Not even that it would cause fights. I've never fought in a relationship actually, which I think is an interesting thing.
And so it's a little telling. It's a little right. It's telling, yeah. And I get that. Yeah.
It's a self-report on me for sure. But so it's like it wouldn't even cause fights, but it would just be like, okay, now we're at this impasse where it's like we have a baseline misunderstanding and there's nothing to do but for me to go, well, but that's okay and move forward, right? Like that's kind of what ends up happening. And I'll even share my very first relationship in high school. I was 17 and it was like first kiss, first love, all the things that a high school relationship and your first boyfriend should like bring and all the butterflies. But one of these things that came up was this idea of like, oh, well, you are so perfect. And I remember one day I told him and I was like, you gotta stop using that word. That is like such a trigger for me. I don't know why, but anytime I hear you say that, I know that it is coming from a place of like admiration and love. It makes me feel like shit because I think deep down I knew he wasn't calling me perfect. He was calling the idea of me perfect. And eventually, when we broke up, he did break up with me. And I will never forget in the conversation that we had when he's kind of leading into this. And he says, I just don't want to hurt you because you're Reese. Who would ever want to hurt Reese? Not you. You're this thing, this golden pedestaled being. So how could I not want to be in a relationship with this, right? But that's not who you're in a relationship with. You're not in a relationship with Reese. You're in a relationship with me. And that is when the discord of, like, fundamentally there are these misalignments come out. And I think that was the thing that was the most difficult in that first experience of, like, losing a romantic love, like having opened up to try and be the recipient of, but then also losing romantic love, was like, oh, it actually doesn't hurt any less when someone rejects the mask of you too. That is still deeply hurtful, because it's like, and it still wasn't enough. And it still would not have changed anything. But it made it really hard for him to be himself around me too, right?
Right, because if you think somebody else is perfect, you have to try to be perfect too.
Oh yeah.
You know, if you have that, I'm curious though, what's it like to share this? Like, what comes up for you as you revisit this, you know, probably 7-8-year-old memory, I'm guessing, in some senses, give or take?
Yeah.
What comes up for you? You know?
Sharing, it's kind of twofold. Sharing personal things is something that I think I have a complicated relationship with, in terms of, like, the public sphere of something that I'm putting out there. And one thing that I'm really working on is the idea that I'm, like, exposing something about someone else, that this is not my story to tell, so it's not fair of me to share this experience when it deeply involves this other person, right? But really working through that and saying, like, they have their own story, their own memory, and I can promise you his recounting of our relationship and of this moment would be vastly different, and there is all the space in the world for that too. But being able to own that this was my experience and this was how it felt is powerful, and it is my story to tell, at least my version of it, and no one gets to take that away from me except myself, which I think I've done a lot over the course of, like, sharing things publicly online. I think it gets harder when it's not, you know, a high school relationship that is about 8 years ago now. It gets harder thinking about, like, sharing things about my family or sharing things in this way that's like, okay, how much of this is mine to tell? Mm-hmm. But still stepping into the power of, no, this is mine to tell. It's just as much mine to tell as anybody's, as long as I am cognizant and conscious of owning my role that I play, and that I am just sharing my, perception of that. That's all I can do, to be honest about it and truthful about it, but that is mine to share, and that's really empowering. I think too, going back to this, because my therapist calls the first time you have a breakup, she calls it the big bad breakup, and she says it arguably is the hardest breakup people will ever go through, regardless of, like, if they get divorced or, like, all sorts of breakups that can happen in your life. She's like, there is something about that first breakup that is just crushing. And so going back to that memory of, it does feel very much like, wow, I kind of sold myself up the river in a lot of ways, in not showing up fully and authentically. I had built around myself as, like, this kind of, like, protective bubble and mask, that it did feel very much like, and it didn't even work, like, such a self-betrayal, that was kind of like, you did all of this, and for what? Mm. Damn.
Wow. I can feel it. I can feel the emotions there in that. And thank you for sharing it with me and being brave enough to share it with the audience as well. And yeah, just that, you know, betrayal is such a strong word, I notice, this betrayal of self. And what I hear, what comes up for me is you know, those parts of you that felt the need to mask to do this were doing so out of such love and concern for you. But this because there's some part of you that's afraid of, if I was who I really was, then I'm unlovable, or
right.
This wouldn't work. And especially if then you have the added pressure of him constantly saying, I'm so perfect. You're so perfect. Oh, you're Reese. You're so perfect. You're up here. And so now there's this polarization between, well, now I have to be perfect. Like you put all this pressure on me to be perfect, and I'm not perfect, because none of us are. And all of us are. Like it's that duality of we are perfect. I love you, you're perfect, now change. Right? I think it's a play. I remember when I was in high school in debate, I feel like that was one of the very popular OI pieces or humorous interpretation pieces that people would do. And I think it's that first love is so deep. And yet I wonder how it's informed future relationships for you. Any thoughts on that? Like how has that, like, you said you were triggered by somebody calls me perfect. How has that manifested, I guess, throughout, since then in your relationships in general, not even necessarily romantic, but.
Right. I think, perfection is something that very much, I think all women, most people, but specifically women, really struggle with, because there is this, I think there's a broader conclusion to be kind of drawn from this first love story for me that is very much kind of what society asks for of women, rising to meet that and then being smashed down anyways, right? That is like society says you have to check these boxes. You have to meet these standards. You have to be the best mother. You have to be a mother. You have to be a good mother. You have to be a wife. You have to be good at cooking. You have to be good at cleaning. You have to manage the household. And even the women and wives in wonderful relationships, there are still lots of reports and studies around the unseen burden and the power imbalance within just like the emotional maintenance of a family unit that women still carry, just because of this kind of baseline society that we live in. You also now, you can't want to throw away a career because of being a mother, but also you can't only want a career. You should want both, and you have to do both beautifully and masterfully. And if you choose to do something different than other women, you cannot say that you are judging women who do something different. You have to be ultimately supportive of all women, even women that you really disagree with. Like, there are all of these impossibilities that are thrusted upon women. And man, are women good at balancing those and tackling those until there is something that understandably is impossible, and society finds this one little chip, this one little crack, and you're a bad mother, you're a bad career person, you're a bad daughter, you're a bad sister, you're like, and then it becomes a deeply personal thing, like, because you can't do these performative actions, you inherently are bad, is very much the message that is sent. And so I think that was largely my experience. That's like, I want this. I want this idealized, almost like Madonna-esque girl. And then as soon as there is something that is like, oh, but you're not actually who I thought, like there's an inconsistency here. But the narrative that exists within all of this is that is judging the self based on external perception, on someone else's standard of what it means to be good or a good woman, not your own standard. And I think that really is the challenge of feminism now, today, is bringing that focus inward. I don't really care what society says a woman is. I feel that I am a woman, and me doing anything that feels true to me is going to be womanly, is going to be feminine, because I am a woman. And I think that that is the challenge now, is prying away the definition of good womanhood from other people's hands and bringing it back to our own hearts, to our own souls, and saying, no, this is mine to define, because it is my role. It is my identity. And even though that identity is something that shapes the way others perceive me, it is not theirs to put parameters around. And I think in terms of it impacting future relationships for me, one thing that's come up a few times in my thoughts throughout our conversation is also this way that I feel that in most of my relationships, no, all of my romantic relationships, I'll say, and I haven't had many. I don't want the listeners to hear this and be like, very experienced person with all of the, no, I have not had many, but with all of my romantic relationships, I am a straight woman, so they have all been with men. Just for context in what we're discussing, I think that's important to note. Because I do think a relationship between two women or a woman and a non-binary person would be different in this power dynamic. I think that all of my boyfriends, I don't want to say partner because I think that carries a different heft. All of my boyfriends have viewed me as a piece of their life that is, that I am checking one of their boxes, not that am something independent that is there to be partnered with, right? And I don't want to blame these men, that I have always been treated extremely respectfully and have always felt very loved and safe in any of my relationships. So I truly still hold nothing but love for these men. I think that that is a societal thing that young men are taught, that whether you fight against it or not, a woman is a thing that a man gets and you kind of need to serve this one specific function, facet in your life. And anything that she wants to do or that is her passion is kind of incidental to that. As long as you also have all of these other things that serve whatever is in this box for you, you're good. And again, I don't think it's their fault. I think it is how young men are taught, that it's like, well, if you're going to take on the world, you need a woman, one, to bear and raise children, but to also like manage the house and all of these other things. And perhaps you want a woman who is driven, who is career oriented, so that you can also kind of have that to be proud of on your arm at business dinners or whatever. But I think oftentimes that is still looked at as her drive makes me look good, not, wow, she has drive.
Wow, that you said a lot. And
yeah, I did. I'm sorry. I've been kind of...
No, stop. Reese, don't you dare apologize, because everything you said is absolutely incredible and worth like five re-listens, because everything you said is absolutely true. I think, wow, so I have to organize my thoughts here. You hit my ADHD brain. I'm going to bounce all over the place. It's awesome. You know, I think the first thing that comes up for me is, you know, men need to do better. I mean, that literally was the first, you know, like you make excuses for us. And yes, there are a lot of reasons why this, you know, it is embedded in our patriarchal society. But there are men who don't feel that way. Who actually, and so it's not something that you can't just, in my opinion, toss it off to if for men listening, to say, oh, well, this is just the way I am. This is the way society made me, because there are men who don't feel don't see their partner, their spouse, their significant other in that way as the word that came is an accessory. That's, yes, that's sort of is the image I got, like a nice pair, a nice set of cufflinks.
Right.
Or, wow, won't she look good on my arm? And we see that everywhere. So, I don't want to give men a pass on that, because you have to do better. I mean, we have to do better. Wow. I mean, just so much there, I think it really also struck for me, the myth of Lilith and Adam. Right. In this sense of that's what really popped up for me, the mythology there. Right. In terms of, according to Jewish mythology, Lilith and Adam were created out of the same substance, in Genesis 1. And again, this is not biblical exactly. It's certainly extra biblical in the sense of it came from legends and myths, in the common era, probably after
more
a lot of this work.
Gnostic traditions.
More Gnostic traditions. But at the same time, this archetype has been around for far longer than the Bible's been around, and before the Bible existed in any way, shape, or form. So but this idea of, I want you to be beneath me. And Lilith is like, no, I'm we're equals. And notice she wasn't trying for domination. There wasn't, I'm better than you, I should be. It was, no, we're equals. We're co-creators. And Adam couldn't handle that. And then he went and whined to God, like, hey, bring her back, because, but she refused to come back and was cursed for it, right? And I mean, that tells us really all we need to know in some senses, because that myth is we see it in our reality.
Yeah.
Every single day. That just really, that struck me there. And I think this idea of perfection is so damaging to women, and in particular, and I think it's damaging to men too, actually, because I think, it's talked about less perhaps, but I think it's still there. And comes out probably in various ways, but for women to have to be perfect. If I'm not perfect, then I'm bad. And right. if I can't afford to have one mistake, I can't let the mask slip, as you said. And then I'm damned if I do, because if the mask makes, the mask doesn't work either. And so what am I supposed to do? How am I supposed to, yeah. To me, the answer is just be. And it goes to, and I'm also reminded of one of the, when we were doing last episode of these meditations, that of leaning into being misunderstood, welcoming being misunderstood, because the right people will hear my, and I'm paraphrasing, but I seek being misunderstood because I know the right people will hear my truth that's for them. And so I feel that maybe that's what love is in some senses, to feel that you don't have to change. You don't have to, you are perfect just the way you are, imperfect as you are. Because your imperfection is perfection. Because wouldn't it be boring if we were all perfect?
Right.
I mean, honestly, like I don't know. The most fun people are the ones who are imperfect. Like, I don't want to be around perfect people, because I can't live up to that. I know I can't live up to that standard. I don't want to live up to that standard. It's almost like, it's almost like I want to get an F on the first paper, so that. I get the brand new car, I'm just going to scratch it myself, because otherwise, it's going to be weighing on me, because it's going to happen.
Yeah.
So let's get it out of the way. And maybe that's how you know you're with the right person, when you can literally be whatever who you are, and there's support, but there's not manipulation. There's not, you need to be this certain way. There's no expectation. The only expectation is that there's open and honestness, and we're here for each other. And you know, you had asked earlier, you know, what does love mean to you, and or how do you define love? To me, I don't know, because it is such a, you know, highbrow topic. I mean, there's so many different, you know, philosophical, and, you know, I mean, you can read the 13th chapter of 1 Corinthians if you really, you know, want to. I think a poetic, talking about beautiful and poetic, regardless of how your impression of the Bible, the 13th chapter of
it's 1 a poetic Corinthians is, and widely is accepted lovely. Definition. Yeah.
But, you know, to me, that's great, but it's not where the rubber meets the road. To me, you know, to me, love is finding somebody that I would be willing to be in an RV with for the rest of my life, and in a confined space where being with them is as pleasant and as wonderful to me as being alone. You know, where I'm just as comfortable, or even more so. Although maybe in some senses it's better to be just as, because why do we need more or less than? But to me, that is the true definition of love, is being around somebody that I am perfectly comfortable being around, and have no need to not be around. And again, I mean, I'm not talking about, we're all going to have this, you know, there's never, you know, you had mentioned, you never really, you know, that in most of your relationships, you haven't had many fights and things like that. But I'm sure there's times you were annoyed, and probably times where it was like, hey, I just need to take a breath. You know, I need a little bit of a break. But I think you know what I mean in terms of, like, hey, if I had to spend the rest of my life in a tiny house with this person, with this other human being, I want that. Like, that doesn't sound like a sentence, like a prison sentence.
Right.
That sounds like a paradise. And I think so many relationships, you know, we pretend they're paradise, but they're really prisons.
Mm.
You know, because we're locked out of being who we really are. Because we don't trust who we don't trust this person enough to be who we really are. If we're honest, we might not call it that.
Right.
You know, we might not notice it. But if we took the time to notice it, all those things you don't tell your partner, every single one of those is to me suggestive of the lack of true safeness, true comfort, true. And again, that doesn't mean you don't love the person. I mean, so it's not a question. That's the only, but that's the definition of love for me that truly resonates with me. You know, I don't know if that's a soulmate. I don't know, you know. I the romantic part of me loves the idea of soulmates being a thing. No, do I think there's just one? I mean, my probabilistic mind says, well, then we're all screwed, because the odds of us finding that one in you know is like picking one molecule of water out of a pool and somebody else picking another and expecting it to be the same kind of thing. I mean, the odds of that are pretty low. That doesn't mean it can't happen, but yeah, I guess that's. I don't know. How does that resonate with you in terms of the definition? What comes up for you in that, hearing that?
Yeah. I completely agree with this idea of it feels the same to be with someone as it does to be alone, right? Like, that is... I don't think that I would ever want to get married to anyone that I didn't have that with, right? Like, that is kind of like, okay, when I feel that, it's like, man, this really is someone that I can build a life with, or do life alongside together in partnership. I think also that is a good analogy for introverts. And maybe extroverts might not feel the same, but I would also say the more time that I've spent with some of my like dearest friends and family, the feeling of being with them and with being alone is still different, but only as of like last year was it the first time that someone besides like my mom, I felt like I could be a full authentic version of myself with, and it still feels a little different than being alone. So I think that there is something kind of magical about the mixing with someone that it's like, I am fully myself, but I'm fully myself with your eyes on me in a whole way that like does add something to that experience. And maybe that is me just being fully romantic, that like I would love for a relationship, a partner where it's like, this is beautiful and even better than being alone. Like you said, why does it have to be better? I don't think it does or should. I think also in my kind of spiritual metaphysic brain, there is a lot of conversation around like, well, God is love, and what is something to believe in if not love, and universal energy is love. And I find that really trite, to be honest. Mm-hmm. I don't necessarily disagree with it, but I think the more that we're sitting here talking, the more I'm like, is love just like witnessing? Is it just holding space for someone's authenticity? And I do think that that is probably what any universal consciousness is too. It's just holding space for your truth.
Without judgment. You know, we've talked about that, right? Like this unconditional, just a space that is completely without judgment, that's radically permissive and radically honest. And you know, as you were saying, and I don't want to interrupt you, but is what came up for me was, is maybe could love be, maybe you truly know your, that you're with the person you should be, or you're in love or whatever, if you can see yourself through that, if you can see yourself through that person's eyes and you actually believe it. Because it goes back to what you were saying before about you couldn't see your first love, or maybe your first boyfriend, maybe it wasn't first love, but your first boyfriend, although maybe it was, and it's beautiful if it was. Like,
right. You know,
so, but I don't want to put words in your mouth, but you know, you couldn't believe how he saw you. And maybe it was true, maybe it wasn't true, who knows, but I'll assume it's true because I think you're perfect. so I agree, but you know, maybe that's when you know that maybe that's what love is when you actually believe what the other person sees, because that is hard. I mean, I don't know, that came up for me. Like maybe that's another way of looking at it, you know?
Yeah. I really, really love that, because I think it is kind of like warts and all, right? That is, I trust that on my worst day, you are going to still see the beauty in me that on my best day I feel, but also on my best day, or if like my ego's getting a little too big, you are also the person who will call me out on that. And that's not exactly what I'm trying to say, right? But it's like to be able to see all sides of someone and still hold that. Like there's this thing that's like good friends call you an asshole. And I'm like, yeah, there is something to that, right? That's like, I wouldn't want to be with someone who doesn't think I'm an asshole sometimes, because I can be an asshole sometimes. We all can. And if you're with someone who can't see that, then they can't see you. There is some sort of smoke and mirrors there. So I do really like that. But to still hold this love, it is not this kind of flowery perfection. The same, it feels the same way as when you hear people say love and light, right? And it's like, not, I think all of these things are extremely well intentioned. This is not, I'm not trying to pass judgment at all. But when it's like with love and light, or the universe is all love and light, it's like, no, it's not. And actually, there's a lot of gifts sitting in the dark and the shadows too. And I don't think that that excludes love. I think that love includes the light and the dark. And so, yeah. Mm. There was one thing I wanted to go back to as well, which is kind of pulling us back a little bit, but it feels important for me to say. After I was talking for a bit and you mentioned that it feels very much like men see women as this accessory. And I completely agree with like that language of kind of how I was talking. Then you were like, not all men feel this way. Absolutely. And I just want to preface that, like, I am extremely blessed to be surrounded by very amazing men that treat their partners really, really beautifully. And I do see them as true partners. And I think my dad's an excellent example of this as well. And I'm very lucky to see that. And I have some friends that just have amazing, amazing, beautiful partnerships that do feel like true partnerships that, it's just a privilege to be able to witness that. I do think also for these men that are able to hold that, they have all done a lot of digging into themselves and into what their masculinity means. And so I think I just want to urge any men out there that may be listening, that if you're like, well, I don't see women like that, I'm one of the good ones, or even, do I see women like that? Just do a little reflection, and maybe you are like, you have fully done this work and you feel confident in that. But I think that there's always more healing to be done. And the more that men heal their own internal wounds that are both from the patriarchy, that are from their inner child, right? This work that men are rarely given the space and time to do, the better you will be a steward of the women in your life and any relationships you have with women, romantic or otherwise. So I think, yeah, like, I agree with you not wanting to let men off the hook, because I think it is something that society kind of predisposes men to have, but also in not letting you off the hook, kind of also giving you permission to have space to work on that, because there might be something there still.
I love that. And it reminds me of a sticker I saw, and it was like, yeah, you know, I understand that, you know, and it was much more pithy than I'll state it as, but it was, because, you know, if you can fit it on a sticker, it's got to be good.
Right.
But it was something along the lines of, you know, yeah, I understand that this is what you've learned, but it's time for you to unlearn this shit.
And, yeah.
You know, I love how you put that in terms of, it's about noticing. Like, if you just take a minute to notice what, you know, how you're thinking. Notice how you're treating somebody. Notice what's in your head and be honest about it, and be brave enough to not just push that down and say, okay, you know, maybe I am doing this. How can I change this? And having that, if you're with somebody, asking them and saying, hey, you know, I've been thinking about this. How am I showing up for you? How could I, what else could I do differently? How could I be better? How could I meet your needs, you know, in a better way? Because often, I mean, I guarantee you, or I don't guarantee you, but I suspect your first boyfriend thought he was meeting your needs in some way by telling you how, maybe thought that's what you were supposed to do. And I have no doubt that it was genuine and probably heartfelt and probably real. But, you know, what is that really saying? You know, again, you know, there's almost a part of you that wants to be acknowledged, you know, that those parts of you that aren't perfect want to be acknowledged, because you know they're there. And can you love me? You know, but then the other thing that came up for me was that, you know, sometimes I've seen this, you know, if you can't love me at my worst, then you don't deserve me at my best, kind of thing, you know, with snaps and stuff. And it's not, that's not what we're talking about here, because it, I mean, yes, that in some senses, maybe the sentiment is true,
right?
You know, but, it's different than that. It's, you know, there's all this aggression I notice in terms of, and even in this empowerment space, there's this, you know, and I understand it needs to be in some senses, like we need to be radical. We need to, the pendulum has to swing in the other direction in order to get balance, because when there's no balance, there's things that happen. But I think your point is so well taken in terms of, you know, how deep this runs. And the other thing is that I'm curious how you respond to this. I would argue, and you know, I was I'm sort of thinking of the trad wife, I think it's called, sort of thing, where like what is, you know, so there are women who want to be an accessory. Like that's perfectly okay with them. And what do you, I'm curious your thoughts on that.
Wow. Yeah. That is something that truly breaks my heart. There, There was something that went viral on TikTok, and I think it's the account Ballerina Farms, and it's this woman who was training to be a ballerina, like wanted to be a ballerina when she grew up, ended up meeting her husband in college when she was studying for ballet, decided not to go into professional dance, and now they have a farm and a homestead, and she is a stay-at-home mom and a mother of like 8, 9 kids, and that's kind of their thing. And very much a part of this trad wife culture and community and the like homesteading kind of thing that I'll just own. I think it's weird as hell. But there is some beauty in like getting back to nature and the health of it, but odd. But they were recording a gift that she was getting for her birthday. And apparently for like a few months, she had been like, I want to go on a vacation to Greece. I want to go on a vacation to Greece. Like, this is all she wants. It has been like a goal of hers to visit Greece. And her husband is videotaping her opening her birthday present. And so she's like, oh my gosh, she's opening it. She's like, oh, is it Greece tickets? And she's like, are these tickets somewhere? And she takes it out and it's an apron with pockets to hold eggs. And just the look on her face that fell, and she was like, oh. And he was like, yeah, you were mentioning that you wanted one of those. And she was like, yeah, I think I did mention that. Yeah, thank you. And she's still very kind and like gracious about receiving this gift. But it's like, not only is it like, you mentioned this one thing once, maybe offhandedly, this other thing so many times, and I don't want to presume to know their finances, but they're quite successful on social media, so I would imagine that a vacation isn't necessarily out of the realm of possibility. But that it's also, like, tied to her doing her mothering work. It's like, why do women get vacuum cleaners and kitchen pans for holidays kind of thing? Even if someone's a chef, then of course, like, it's a little bit different and all of those types of things, right? But it's just so heartbreaking because I think even in the women that we see kind of in these communities, this is one of those things that I was like, there is something universal about the human experience, or the womanly experience, even for women that have kind of quote unquote chosen the path to be an accessory. That is, I don't think anyone's spirit wants that actually. And I think it takes a lot of mental gymnastics to make that cognitive dissonance work. I think it takes so much energy day in, day out for women to play that role. And I think for women who have decided to, there is a lot to uncover. And I think that uncovering all of that scares them more than the idea of living inauthentically. I think it's easier. And I do think that that's a choice that women get to make, like the same way anyone gets to choose how they want to live, right? Like, I'm not here trying to strip away anyone's freedom for the choices they make. And I don't want to sit here and say that, like, I know their hearts either. Maybe I'm totally wrong, but that's just my two cents on, I cannot imagine anybody who wants to live as though they're an accessory. And that just has to take a certain level of self-suppression and, like, arguably self-hatred. I really think so. And in doing this healing work, I think that it does require you to confront, even like I was talking about earlier with my first boyfriend and realizing that I had betrayed myself. It takes that. It takes being a little upset at who you've allowed yourself to be for yourself and not having defended yourself, at not having been the one to stick up for yourself. But then it also takes self-forgiveness to say, the society and culture I'm born into does not encourage this, and my genetics are partially wired from my ancestors that have all, like, you're carrying all this baggage from that, right? And so, yeah, I would say, like, hold space for your anger in any way, but then also meet that with grace in any way. And it's hard to talk about that because you could probably hear in my language, I'm so hesitant to not judge another woman for a choice she's making. But it's like, even in that, she's judging me for the choices I'm making. So
we tend, yeah, that's a very, I appreciate you sharing that. And I do wonder if anybody, you know, I would love to hear from somebody who is, you know, likes this or wants to be part of this, yeah, this lifestyle. I don't judge it. And what you said was very interesting to me. And it kind of goes back to, you know, this idea of, okay, if a woman is a sex worker, mm-hmm, is that empowering or is that because of abuse or because of childhood trauma and a lack of self-worth or, you know, where is the power in that? And is there if somebody did choose, hey, I just want to be taken care of. I love being a mother. It's what I enjoy. I don't want to work. Like, work sounds like I just want to, you know, take care of my kids. I love homemaking. I enjoy cooking. I love making pies. I just love all of this. Like, I don't want to think about bills. They scare me. I like that my husband takes care of everything. If somebody chooses that, is that not a form of empowerment in some sense?
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
Is the other question. That's a question, you know, from my perspective, the male perspective, I would say, you know, if, yes, as long as it's been explored, you know, I would definitely say, hey, let's make, you know, if this is what you want, this is, you have that agency, and if you're feeling, you know, to me that is powerful to say, no, this is, I love this. Like, my husband treats me well. I'm very happy with how I'm treated. Like, I don't feel I'm treated poorly. This is the life I choose, and I love it. So who are you to judge me? And they're right. And, you know, it's not for me to say, oh, well, you know, well, that's because you were, your childhood was messed up. And so, you know, that you have this as a model, but this shouldn't be this way. So I don't know. It's hard to, I get what you're saying in terms of, you know, how do I even respond? Like, I try to hold these two things, right?
And I think, and in the language of something that you're saying, because I don't disagree with anything that you just said at all. And I think that what I was just speaking to was perhaps, I don't think I categorized it super effectively in saying that it's an empowered choice, right? As opposed to this disempowered state of, I have to do this. Mm-hmm. And I think that is the latter of the two was what I was trying to speak to. And I think when I hear the word tradwife, my mind immediately goes there, which speaks to my bias around that. So I'll own that, right? That, like, in thinking of these, like, homesteading lifestyles, my mind does immediately go to, is this kind of a disempowered way of living? But absolutely 100% agree that if it has been explored, and if this is something that brings you joy, there is so much beauty in being a mother, and there is so much beauty in taking care of a home and baking and cooking and just like the heart of nurturing, right? In every sense of the word, that's beautiful. And there is something really beautiful in being taken care of too. I think that my gut instinct is just that because that can also be the default, exploring whether that is your default or not before is my kind of, mm-hmm, ooh, it's difficult. So I hope that did not come across as discounting at all of women who make the choice to do this. I think when I hear trad wife too, I also tend to think MAGA, and then that also makes me think really sexist. So
there's a ton of connotation.
Yeah.
I totally agree. But what you described, though, I mean, I have to say that I haven't seen the video that you were talking about with the apron, and but I mean, honestly, that made me tear up as you were talking about it because that just seems so heartbreaking, you know, and so, you know, and it brings up anger and it brings up all, you know, indignation in me personally, like, oh, you got to rise up against this. But I do want to point out that, you know, that there's agency here, you know, unless it's a situation where there is no, you know, obviously there's some situations where, you know, certain places, certain situations where you don't have agency, And that's a very different situation.
I don't
know how we got on this. It was an interesting.
No, you know, I think it's like fascinating.
It could be a form of empowerment in some ways.
Totally.
You know, that's what you really, really want. It goes back to what do you want?
Yes.
I don't, you know, there's no judgment there. Like, you know, it takes all kinds, and that could be a beautiful calling, but is it really your calling? Is that what your heart wants? That's where I think we go back to it, right? It's if it's what your heart wants, then it's what's for you, and that's okay, and that's great,
right.
And walk in it and enjoy it, and hopefully you don't allow yourself to be treated poorly by your husband or wife. I mean, you know, we're talking about this, but you know, there's the opposite end too, which isn't talked about as much. But, you know, a female-led relationship is sort of the opposite of a trad wife. So, you know, I mean, that doesn't get much talk either, but that exists as well. You know,
you
can't have one without the other in some senses. Like,
yeah,
the opposite, right? And
yes.
I mean, I think it's really interesting, the dynamic, because even in a trad wife situation, who actually holds the power? You know, is it always the husband? You know, I mean, I don't know. I'm not saying it is or it isn't. I'm wondering. You know, and that maybe this is probably a different topic in terms of the dynamic of power and what power, how power and desire intersect. It's funny, when I was in college, my freshman year, I took probably the best course I've ever taken in my life. And I don't know if you're still alive, Dr. Snodgrass, but if you are, I want to shout out to you. Maybe this will get back to you. It was just an absolutely incredible course, and it was called Power and Desire in Western Thought. And that was a philosophical but also practical course where we looked at these concepts of power and desire and what it means. And one of the books one of the things we actually looked at was the movie Dangerous Liaisons. Which was based on a book from, I think, the 1700s, which was French, and it was actually an epistolary. It was all written in the series. And we only had to watch the movie, but I actually read the book as well because it was fascinating. The power dynamic in that, and that's something I think we could spend a whole episode. I don't know if have you ever seen Dangerous Liaisons, the original with John Malkovich?
Once forever ago, so I don't remember it, but I'm writing it down to add to my list.
That might be something interesting, you know, for us to look at one day, because there's a fascinating dynamic there in that between, you know, incredible actors in that, including, you know, John Malkovich and Glenn Close, I think it was. I wanted to say Meryl Streep, but I think it was Glenn Close. A tour de force of acting, in my opinion, but more than that, what underlies it, this the power dynamic, and what true power is, and what living free is,
I also want to say, like, this Ballerina Farms family, this example, even though I totally agree, the story is just really difficult to hear. I also have no idea what the inner workings of their life, right? And I think that that's also something we all need to just be mindful of, is we're only getting glimpses into these people that are sharing their lives on the internet. So it's like, yeah, this is maybe one thing that was really, really shitty. She may absolutely love her life and end up going to Greece next year for her birthday, right? We have no idea. So I want to kind of humble myself in my jump to judgment there too, but I think it's also
how you feel, Reese. I mean,
and
it brings up, and I think that it's valid, and I think it's also valid to say, and I don't judge this. It doesn't feel good to me. It makes me feel sad. It makes me feel,
right.
You know, but also recognizing, holding space to say, and that's her, you know, I respect her choice as well.
Yeah.
And you know, and in fact, if somebody out there knows her and wants to we'd love to talk with her and understand it, because there is no judgment, honestly. It's a way of being, and it's not right or wrong. And it's beautiful,
right.
if she's happy and there's love and it's edifying, then who are we to judge? You know,
yes.
With the manner you judge, you know, you'll be judged. You know,
yeah.
That is basically how you judge others is how you're going to. And again, for a long time, I took that as God's going to judge me that way. But the real truth of it is, in my opinion, is that the way you judge others is just reflective of the way you judge yourself. And if you judge others harshly, you're probably judging yourself harshly. And is that what you want? Do you want to judge yourself harshly? And I don't. I do sometimes, unfortunately, but less and less. The more I walk in this, the less I judge myself. Now I examine myself. There's a difference, I think, between examining oneself and judging oneself. And you know, I can examine myself and say, "Oh, I notice I did do this. Wow, you know, why did I do this? Is this who I am? Is this who I want to be?" And if the answer is no, then it's like, okay, that's good to know. Let's see when that, you know, let's make a shift in that behavior. If we notice it, let's be more conscious of it. Let's see where it comes up. So yeah.
Last thing I just wanted to say, since you brought up the Lilith mythology, and I've just been really thinking about what I think about this. And so I'll throw it out there for if you have any quick thoughts or to marinate on maybe for next week or listeners to hear your thoughts. Yeah. But how Eve kind of came in as the second wife made from Adam, and that there is very much this dichotomy between the Lilith archetype and the Eve archetype. But there's this theory, myth, kind of assigned meaning that perhaps the serpent that appears to Eve in the Garden of Eden is Lilith in her serpent form. And I have just been really meditating on Lilith's serpent form and the idea of like venom as something that can be so powerful also in our words. Like when you spit venom at someone, that is a way we talk about like using our words to hurt somebody, how powerful that can be, but also how the serpent is never once in the actual Bible ever named as the devil or as Satan or as Lucifer. It is only ever discussed as the serpent. Of course, there's other Gnostic traditions that actually say the serpent is a manifestation of Jesus, of the Christ figure, which I think is also interesting. But I've just been really loving meditating on the idea that it is Lilith come to set Eve free with knowledge. And I would love to hear your two cents, or if we want to put a pin in that for next week too.
I would love to talk about it in more detail, but my initial thought is, I do love that idea, number one, of you know, whether or not it's, I mean, again, do we really think this story is true? True anyway. So
right.
I think we can put, but what is interesting, you know, not only, you know, a modern, you know, most Christians would say, oh, that's the devil. I mean, that's what I grew up learning, right? The snake,
right, same.
The snake was the devil, which is never, ever mentioned. Even more than that, though, what's very interesting is God was the one who lied in Genesis. He said, the day you eat of this fruit, you shall surely die. And they ate of the fruit and they didn't die. Now, apologetics and other Christians, but, oh, well, that was metaphorical. Well, the problem there is if you actually read understand the text and read the Hebrew, and I'm not suggesting I do, but if you really want to, I highly recommend Dan McClellan. He has an incredible channel on YouTube and TikTok and dispels all of this. And so a lot of what I'm just regurgitating things that he shared in the past. But I think it's important to recognize that like the God of the Bible is the one who lied and lied to keep knowledge from people. You know, when they ate of the tree, they became as gods, knowing the difference between good and evil. And so the God that, you know, of Christianity apparently does not want people to have knowledge, which doesn't sit right with me as a concept. Not to mention that he didn't tell the truth. They didn't die immediately. Yeah, and the people, oh, well, you know, a day is like a year and 1,000 years is like a day. And again, that's just a lot of hand-wringing. That's a lot of manipulation to basically make that argument to everyone who agrees with them so they feel good at night. Oh, no, it can't be, you know, like, And again, I think this goes back to the shadow that you're talking about, this darkness, this idea of there's parts of us that know that something's wrong, I would say, but we won't allow ourselves, many of us won't allow ourselves to actually think critically here. Because when you start to think critically, the whole sweater unravels. It really does. And and to me, that represents what Lilith represents, is truth, is knowledge, even if it burns you. Like, knowledge is power. Knowledge, we are meant to know and to feel and to, to be. That's what comes. I would love. We can always talk more about this.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just. I want people to. And again, I come across sometimes as like being anti-Christian, or I sometimes there's a part of me that fears that, and I'm not. I did spend a lot of my life under a lot of oppression and a lot of restriction and a lot of you should and a lot of and when I actually learned to think for myself and examine these things and actually think about them uncomfortably, it led me, to a different place. It led me to questioning a lot of things. And the fact is, pastors and preachers and they don't priests and they don't want people to question because there's no answers to these questions. And you have to make up answers that aren't really true and aren't really satisfying. And, whereas I think exploring and seeing who you are we talked about shadow work, this idea of our shadow is every bit as powerful as our non-shadow. Like there's that duality. Like you can't all the shadow is just another part of you. It's there whether you want to see it or not. And again, when you cast a shadow on something, we say that's a bad thing. Oh, my shadow. But think about like in the desert, and maybe I've mentioned this before, but all the animals seek shade and refuge in the shadow. Like the Bible talks about the shadow of the wings of the Almighty. So why do we pull back from the idea of talking about our shadow or thinking about our shadow? So great discussion today. I love where we went. There's a part of me that wonders, do we just wander around? But I guess we'll see.
I think we do, but I think that's kind of awesome. I'll also throw out there, Dan McClellan, great recommendation. Esoterica is also a YouTube channel that I love with Dr. Sledge, I'm maybe forgetting his first name, as a rec. He actually has a video on the historic myth of Lilith that is fabulous, highly recommend, and a lot on Jewish mysticism and Gnostic Christianity and a lot around kind of the more metaphysical myths here too. So I'll just throw that out there as another rec before we sign off here. Dennis, as always, thank you so much. This is, it's just such a joy to chat and to share. And thank you, listeners, for being a part of Bow Down, for being a part of our coherence. And we thank you for letting us be this small sliver in your coherence. It is such an honor and a privilege.
Likewise, it is just a joy. Like I take so much joy from really just, I don't even view the audience. I just see a conversation and it's lovely. It's just so lovely. So thanks to everyone listening and we'll catch you next week.
Bow Down is a weekly podcast from the Cohere Collective that explores esoteric and empowered feminism.
Please subscribe to Bow Down wherever you may be listening. And if you enjoyed the episode, please leave us a like, a 5-star rating, and a review. And if there's anyone you think would enjoy this episode, or maybe just needs to hear it, please share it.
If you want to stay up to date on all things Bow Down, you can follow the Cohere Collective on any social media platform at the Cohere Collective and check out other content and offerings at www.thecoherecollective.com.
If you're interested in working with Reese to find and pursue your purpose, I encourage you to head to www.thecoherecollective.com/life-coaching.
If you're interested in working with Dennis to shed your mask and embrace your desires, you can email Dennis at dennis@theheartstoybox.com.
Huge thank you to Jack Corbett for Bow Down's music. You can find him on Instagram at j.corbe. Thank you all for joining us today. We're so glad you're here.
And as always, we hope you feel like you are living more coherently. And until next time, love.